Well, we get the show underway this afternoon by welcoming into the program a singer-songwriter who's been making great music for more than four decades now. He burst on the scene in the 70s with hits like People Gotta Move and I Just Wanna Stop. We had a chance to catch up recently with Gino Vannelli, who explained that, it all started for him growing up in a very musical home.
Yeah, my dad was a cabaret singer in the late 40s, early 50s. And I had the privilege of seeing him perform when I was 3 or 4 years old. I remember him in his vanilla white canvas suit up in Quebec City. And he was singing songs like Unchained Melody and, you know, Temptation and all those classics. And I sort of decided then and there that was something I wanted to chase.
And you were drawn to jazz drummers, people like Buddy Rich and Ed Thigpen, Gene Krupa. What was the attraction to them?
Well, you know, that's a funny thing. You know, I really did love the idea of singing and music in general, but I saw a couple of either documentaries or movies on, I think it was one with Gene Krupa, then another one on Buddy Rich, and something kind of infiltrated inside of me, and I started tapping my hands on tables by the time I was 5 or 6. And then by the time I was 7 or 8, my dad bought me a pair of bongos that I managed to always put over the stove because they didn't have any keys to tighten the skin. So the only way to tighten the skin was to heat it up. So I used to hold my bongo over the stove and make sure the skins were nice and tight, and that was good for at least an hour. And by the time I was 10, an uncle of mine bought me a cocktail drum that was so large that I had to have a little stool to stand and play on it. And so I had a cocktail drum with a cymbal and a bass drum that hit the bottom of a cocktail drum that looked like a very kind of like a towering tom-tom. And for 2 years I practiced on that. And finally, I was hired as a drummer to... as a relief drummer for a major club in Montreal, and I had joined a group called the Cobras when I was 12, and then my brothers and I had a series of groups on our own.
Now, you also, if I remember correctly, for your audition, well, you played what everybody who played the drums played back at that time, and that was Wipeout.
Well, that was the rite of passage, wasn't it? I mean, if a pop drummer couldn't play Wipeout, you know, he couldn't play for your band. So I remember coming home from school. I heard the twanging of a guitar and some rat-tat-tang of a snare drum and a cymbal. And I was drawn to it, my school bag, you know, hanging on my back. And I saw a line of kids, you know, from the ages maybe 16 to 20 years old, a line of 7 to 10 kids. Waiting to audition for the group called the Cobras. And it was in somebody's garage on the corner of a suburban street. And so I waited in line. And I was very late coming home. My mom was worried about me, as she told me when I got home. But I waited in line, and when came my time, I said, "What do you want?" And they said, "Well, just play Wipeout." And I said, "Okay, no problem." And there it went. And so they came to me and said, "Well, how old are you?" And I lied. I said I was 13, but I was 12. And I just wanted to be a teenager. But they said, if you want to join the group, you're welcome to join the group. And I was elated. So I went home late. So my mom was mad. But I said, "Well, the good news is, though, I just joined the group." And she was further furious.
Now, also when you were a young man, you embraced classical music, too. Was that the influence of your father?
A little bit, because my father had, inklings towards opera and things of that nature. But really, that came about because in our elementary school, every first or last Thursday of the month, we had free passes to go see the Montreal Symphony rehearsed. And almost like a dress rehearsal before their concerts. And so it started off one Thursday I went, and they were doing, practicing the piece by Ravel called Daphne and Chloe. And I marveled at the harmonies and the sounds that just, to me, It wasn't sound. It was images that it was evoking, and I was so impassioned by it that I said, "Where did that sound come from?" So that also became a real deep passion and hobby of mine, to study the orchestra and how it was made, and the range of violins and what the role of the tuba was and the glockenspiel and so on and so forth. So from the ages of about 9 or 10 on, that also was a hobby of mine. And so by the time I got to where I was signed up to A&M, I already had a good understanding of what the symphony orchestra was.
We're talking with Gino Vannelli here on Dante. Well, let's talk, if we can, about getting signed by A&M Records. And, you had an opportunity and you took advantage of it in the parking lot, right, when you tracked down Herb Alpert?
Well, you know, it was an interesting lesson. You know, the lesson was, of course, I had been in Los Angeles for 4 months, knocked on practically every door, and every door was shut in my face. By the time I was 20, 21 years old. And I just stopped into a church one day, fell asleep, and felt I knew what to do, almost like as if I had seen the movie role or the trailer. And I sat or stood in front of A&M gates for about 2-3 hours, and when I saw Herb come out, I just ran through the gate, accosted him, and pulled away by the guard. But finally, Herb asked me what I wanted and pulled me away from the clenches of the guard. And I just said, give me a chance to just play for you. And I came back 30 minutes later and did so. And that's when I started my career at A&M Records. So the lesson was not only perseverance and just keep doing it and keep going, and even in the face of all adversity or darkness or, you know, don't surrender. But it was also a lesson in that perhaps there is something in ourselves that we don't know, some machination or some wheel works that exist that has the ability to guide us where there is no guide. It was a great lesson in both things.
You ended up with your first top 40 hit in the States with People Gotta Move in 1974. Was that a surreal experience to hear yourself on the radio?
You know, it kind of was, but the way I was wired is that I was looking for what was wrong with the record. And so what I could do to improve upon, you know, production and singing and so on and so forth. And certainly by the time we recorded Storm at Sunup in 1975, I think I had made some leaps and bounds, you know, in regards to my own ability.
You also toured with Stevie Wonder and ended up performing on Soul Train. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, Stevie, you know, was at a hotel that I was staying at, and I was kind of napping, and I heard Crazy Life, the title of my first album, being sung, and it, lo and behold, it was Stevie. And so we exchanged hugs, and he asked me then and there to open up or to play with him for 7 or 8 concerts because Chaka Khan was not going to be available. And I wanted to, but I was a little hesitant. I asked him, I said, am I, you know, going to be slaughtered or what? he said, no, he had a very, 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 you know, cool audience. And lo and behold, he was right. For the 7 or 8 concerts that took place, I enjoyed myself immensely, and Stevie was very, very gracious. He gave me consideration for all things, sound checks and all that. And while I think I was in Cleveland or Cincinnati, I got a call from Don Cornelius, who heard about the tour. And by that time, People Gotta Move was climbing the charts, especially the R&B charts. I think it was top 10. Gave me a call and asked me to do Soul Train. And I told him, do you know that I'm white? Yeah, but here we think we consider you off white, so he's coming to the show.
I love it. 1978, you released what became a tremendous success of the Brother to Brother album, and it really was a family affair produced by your brothers. Your brother Ross wrote the giant hit, I Just Want to Stop, which is one of those songs I actually just heard it on our station about an hour ago. And it's one of those songs that's just so timeless. You hear it today, and it sounds as fresh as it did then.
Yeah, you know, I had a pretty good career going by the mid-70s. I was selling out every theater and doing the kind of music I really wanted to do. And Brother Joe really kind of advised me that I ought to be thinking about broadening the audience, expanding, and maybe having a big hit single. And I wanted it, Rich, but some part of me knew that once I crossed that threshold and really had that kind of success, I would be forever chasing it. So I was reluctant. But Ross came to me with a pretty good sketch of "I Just Want to Stop," and kind of smelled blood in the waters, and we produced it, and of course the rest is history.
And back with your next album, Nightwalker, another top 10 hit with "Living Inside Myself." But at that point, were you chasing it, or were you still able to make the kind of music you wanted to make?
Well, I found out by that time that I could actually maybe have my cake and eat it too. And in this sense, that I could pursue an album filled with ideas, musical ideas that were echoing and reverberating in my head. At the same time, be conscious of the fact that it would be very beneficial to have a lot of airplay, you know, and to be on radio. But I didn't, to be honest with you, I didn't pursue it as one would pursue wholeheartedly, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, to be so cognizant that you're aiming every detail towards having a single. It just came, I wrote a song called "Living Inside Myself," and I said, "Oh, this maybe could be a single. I like the song anyways, whether it is or not." And then the more I played it for myself, I demoed it. I said, "You know what? I think Arista will like this as a single." They did, but they didn't really want to release it as a single until they computer tested it and did all kinds of crazy things. And then finally, they told me, "Well, it doesn't test that really well." I said, "I don't. You know, people are not under normal situation when they're being tested while they're hearing music. You know, it's kind of like the dating game. You know, when people say they want a date, it's very much different which they would probably date." Any case, we released it, and I think got to number 5 or 6.
In the 90s, you got to really explore your love of jazz with a couple of terrific albums, Yonder Tree and Slow Love. Is it great to have that freedom to really just think about making the kind of music that you love?
Yes, that's a good question, Rich. I think at a certain point, you know, after the success of Black Cars, First to Be in Love, and Wild Horses, especially worldwide, I was nearing 40 years old, and I said, "You know what, this is going to end, and I don't want to chase this anymore. I have so many ideas musically that if I box myself, if I paint myself into a corner, I'm going to be so frustrated." So I began to pursue the more esoteric or the more sidetrack or service road kind of music, where those who want to stop and listen can stop and listen. And it was a bit of a change of perspective, because, you know, you're not going to release something and like Yonder Tree and expect, you know, to hear your voice on the radio, you know, 20 times a day. So you have to set yourself up emotionally for that. And I did. So after the years of pursuing that, I got to do a lot of things like, sing and write and orchestrate for the Metropole Orchestra, 60-piece orchestra in the Netherlands, and a really fine record that came out called The North Sea. Then do things like canto with classical orchestras, and then get to play with various classical orchestras from South America to North America and Europe. And I actually get to perform for Pope John Paul because of that classical end. And those early days of listening to classical music as an elementary school kid really paid off, because I really had it inside of me, and I really knew what direction would sound best for my voice.
And I
wrote about it.
And canto and the performance for the Pope really began, as I understand it, with a song that you recorded as a tribute to your father.
Yes, called Parole per mio padre, and it means the words to my father. And my father had just passed away a couple of years earlier, and I wrote some sort of maybe a musical eulogy, you'd call it, and that's what Parole per mio padre. And somehow, some way, Pope John Paul got to hear the song, which was recorded prior to Canto, on an album by Niels Landoki, a piano player from Denmark that I produced. He liked the song so much, he wanted to play the piano part to it, and that I did it on his record. And that was the first recording of it. And somehow, some way, Pope John Paul heard that, and I got a call from the Vatican to ask me to perform that song for the Pope.
Your most recent album, Wilderness Road, is absolutely terrific. I love the bluesy feel of Older and Wiser. I almost picture Sinatra in a little club late at night. And The Woman Upstairs is a great song, too.
You know, The Woman Upstairs, I'm very partial to that because, nice that you should mention it, because it's a true story. There was a terrible thing going on upstairs. A woman was being battered every night. And those days, nobody wanted to say anything about it, you know, and eventually it ended in tragedy, and that's what the song depicts.
You've also turned to writing in a different realm, and that's with your book, Stardust in the Sand. Is it great to have that additional creative outlet?
It is, because a lot of people, like in this interview, a lot of people ask me questions, and sometimes as we're conversing, images, you know, and memories come up that I almost forgot. And as I was just jogging my memory, trying to write some liner notes for an album called Best and Beyond, the liner notes became so detailed that the record company, which was Azura Records from Rome, asked me to expand it and to write a little compendium or a little journal or. And that's what I did. That's what Stardust in the Sand is. It's sort of a journal of how I felt before and after many songs that people know, and the awkward moments of meeting a lot of famous artists that I met over the course of 30, 40 years.
You know, we're up here in Boston Celtics country. We have fond memories of Geno time at the Garden a few years back.
But some things happen all by their random self, so... What that is.
Well, Geno, it's been great to talk with you. I've enjoyed your music for a long time. Great to see you out there continuing to make music, and hopefully when the world turns around, to get back performing for the fans as well. And we really appreciate you making time for us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Rich. You take care.